Good evening, Lionel.
Happy Easter, Daniel.
Happy Easter. Get any eggs?
I did get some chocolate eggs. Yeah, I've eaten a bit too much chocolate egg today. I feel somewhat a sort of sickly feeling. I'm trying to wash it all down now with a Leffe Zero, just to sort of balance out the flavours.
Well, I've got a San Miguel Zero, so cheers, Lionel. And, well, we have just witnessed a Tour of Flanders, which has certainly lived up to everyone's expectations and probably the wildest hopes, dreams of the organisation, in the sense that we had the quartet, some would call it a quintet, but certainly the sort of four horsemen of the apocalypse: Remco Evenepoel, Tadej Pogacar, Mathieu van der Poel, and Wout van Aert, very much to the fore. This is Arrivé. We do give away spoilers pretty early in the episodes, generally. So, Lionel, do you just want to go about the formalities and just put on record who did win this 110th edition of the Tour of Flanders?
I was going to ask whether you got any chocolate eggs, Daniel, or whether this is something that I don't like chocolate eggs. I like chocolate, but not in the form of an egg or some kind
really
of...
You don't really eat chocolate.
Of course you don't, no. Happy Easter anyway. Hopefully you got a lovely bunch of flowers. Well, the flowers went to Tadej Pogacar, the world champion. As you say, Daniel, the four horsemen, four bikemen of the apocalypse, perhaps even make that five, because Mads Pedersen was desperately trying to hold on to the coattails, wasn't he? But we saw the five best riders in classics racing at the moment get clear in roughly the order I think we would have expected them to, given their status and their current form.
And it felt slightly post-apocalyptic at the end, didn't it, Lionel, with those four themselves and certainly the field behind them sort of scattered to all four corners. It felt like they were sort of scattered to all four corners of Flanders' huge time gaps at the finish line. And in stark contrast, really, to Milan-San Remo, the first monument of the year, and probably in stark contrast to the podcast that we did, the Arrivé we did after that, it was a sort of, I don't want to say that the mood was somber at the finish line. That was the word that Tom Pidcock used, wasn't it, after Strade Bianche, after the last sort of demonstration, solo demonstration by Tadej Pogacar. But if that race, Milan-San Remo, was all about uncertainty, this holy grail that he'd been pursuing for many years, today felt more about fatality, inevitability.
Yeah, it did. I mean, Tadej Pogacar's won the Tour of Flanders, Ronde van Vlaanderen, for the third time in his career, equaling the record, pipping Mathieu van der Poel, who was aiming for an outright record fourth win. And, well, the big surprise, Remco Evenepoel was engaged in a real desperate, futile, agonising chase for what felt like the whole of Sunday afternoon. But in terms of race drama, it was really back to the sort of Pogacar knocking down a wall with a sledgehammer in sort of three blows, wasn't it? And I think from 100 kilometres to go, and this is these nuances of the fine drama of bike racing, you could have written down, and I'm not being wise after the event here, but it was obvious where things were going to happen. And it was pretty obvious what was going to happen. And there were enough clues as to who was losing ground when the gaps were opening. There wasn't a great deal of surprise, because we knew that if the gaps closed back up again, if Remco Evenepoel had managed to get back on, he would have gone backwards again as soon as they reached the next climb. And so it did feel a bit like, if we use the phrase, sort of classic by numbers, paint by numbers, it was this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. And I think it was fairly obvious from a long way out how it was going to unfold. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't a race without nuance and interest and some excitement. But it was just, there was just no uncertain variable. There wasn't a surprise rider in there. There wasn't a moment where, oh, actually, is this not going to fall the way we think? Other than perhaps when Pogacar made his final move the last time up the Alpe de Quadamont, and the gap wasn't as big and his move wasn't quite as emphatic as it had been in the past. But the thing was that the next bit of sort of false flat uphill after the Alpe de Quadamont, he opened the gap enough. And then it was just everybody riding to the finish with a raging tailwind in the order that they'd gone over the top of the Al de Quarnamont.
Of course, there could still be a huge twist because there is a not quite developing story is that Tadej Pogacar might be led away in handcuffs after the Tour of Flanders this evening. He and about 30 or 40 others, I think, we think around about that number, because of an incident early in the race. We'll get to that in just a minute. Lionel, should we tell people roughly what happened in this 110th running of the Tour of Flanders, the Ronde van Vlaanderen, Lionel?
Well, it all started on April Fool's Day, really, didn't it? Because the news broke that Remco Evenepoel was going to make his debut at the Tour of Flanders. I looked this up when the news broke, because it was announced on April Fool's Day, and I can't be the only person who thought that this was just an elaborate joke, because they had been emphatic, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, that Remco Evenepoel was not going to ride the Tour of Flanders this year. He, until today, was the only Belgian man who's won the rainbow jersey in the World Road Race Championships who's never lined up to ride the Tour of Flanders. So he was clearly going to ride it one day. The question then was whether he would be able to match the likes of Pogacar and Van der Poel. And I have to say, some of the pre-race sort of speculation about this was, I thought, a bit strange. You'd have thought from some of the reaction that Evenepoel had won Liège-Bastogne-Liège on a bike equipped with stabilisers. You know, there's such was a discussion about whether he can go downhill, whether he can corner well enough, whether he can cope with some cobblestones. I mean, you know, his elite level cobblestone classic racing is thin on the ground compared to some of the others, but he has won a Brabantse Pale. He's won stages of the Baloise Belgium Tour that have gone over the Mur and the Bosberg and so on. But it was nevertheless probably the pre-race story, because Belgium has this long drought now, currently the longest ever run without a Belgian winner in the Tour of Flanders. It's now 9 years and counting. Philippe Gilbert in 2017 was the last Belgian winner. So they were the kind of pre-race stories, weren't they?
And it's a trifling drought, if you ask a Frenchman.
Well, quite.
It's not really representative of the current situation, the current climate in Belgian cycling. No one's really been talking, neither should they be talking, about a crisis in Belgian cycling over the last few years, because they've been very, very much at the forefront of affairs, just not winning the Tour of Flanders. Lionel, weather was, it looked to me, well, it was pretty windy, changeable. We had some pretty heavy showers throughout the day, and certainly the wind would affect things, particularly in that last phase of the race, I would suggest. But the first significant move, Lionel, was with around 250 kilometres to go. So early on in the day, we had a fairly big move, and that big move was able to put some fresh air between themselves and the peloton. Sylvain Dillier, Frédéric Frison, Victor Verculli, Jean Baljan, Sam Bayard, Camille Gradec, Luc Lamperti, Conor Swift, Luca van Boven, Dries de Poeter, Julius Vandenberg, Eduardo Zamperini, and Hartes de Vries went away.
Yeah, 13 riders, quite a big group. And it took a long while for that break to go, actually, almost 30 kilometres. And the reason for that was the headwind start, I think. But the key things about that break were that Sylvain Dillier of Alpecin Premier Tech, Mathieu van der Poel's teammate, who of course rode almost three quarters of Milan San Remo on the front, he got into that break, which really threw the spotlight and the onus onto UAE Team Emirates, Tadej Pogacar's team, to then ride on the front of the peloton. And they had to do a lot of work. And as you say, Daniel, the break kind of edged up a bit, a minute, then a couple of minutes. Mikael Bjerg and Nils Pollitt were kind of taking turns riding on the front for UAE. And then the big moment, when the gap was around 3 minutes and a bit, 213 kilometres to go, the level crossing came down. 30 or so riders got through, including Pogacar and some of his UAE Team Emirates teammates. The rest all stopped. Some debate about, you know, when did the red light start flashing? Was there a siren? Once the barriers were down, the riders had stopped well before then. We don't know. We're only speculating here at this point whether or not the red light was showing when the first riders went through. But it does seem that the red light started as the peloton was going through. And so, you know, some were through without breaking the rules. Some nipped through and then everybody else stopped. Now, of course, this is a big no-no, isn't it? You're not allowed to go through a red light or under a barrier, certainly not under a barrier when a level crossing comes down. So what was interesting was that when they got going again, they didn't slow the brake down. They didn't hold the time gap to the brake. So the brake got its advantage up to about 5.5 minutes at that point.
Lionel, you say you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to go through a red light or a level crossing. Well, that's as far as both the UCI rules are concerned, as far as the commissaires are concerned, and as far as the local rules, laws in Belgium are concerned. And I mentioned, I so glibly mentioned the breaking story, that there are reports currently, and time is 29 minutes past five at the moment, that the Belgian public parquet, what's that, prosecutor, Belgian police anyway, may want those who are identified as having gone through that red light to appear before him or her tomorrow to explain themselves. And the commissaires as well could, in theory, have something to say. Lionel, and there is, in these instances, it's a bit like when there are a large number of riders who finish outside the time limit. There's a critical mass of a number of riders, which dictates usually whether the relevant sanctions are imposed or not. You occasionally get sort of huge groups of riders dumped out of races when they finish out of the time limit. There was a famous incident in Tirreno Adriatico in 1998 where Carmine Castellano unfortunately passed away just a couple of weeks ago. He dumped over 100 riders out of the time limit because he thought that they were sort of taking the mickey. That was as a sort of statement. But in this instance, it would potentially mean ejecting Remco Evenepoel and Tadej Pogacar. I don't think that's going to happen, do you?
I don't think so, no. And I mean, without seeing definitive pictures of when the red light was flashing and which riders had got through, and also giving a slight benefit of the doubt, if you're in the sort of arrowhead of the peloton, could you see the light? There's too many variables here. There's been, 4.5-5 hours of racing for the commissaires to, you know, issue warnings to the team cars or say, look, we're going to look into this. We've not heard that that's the case. And it's not as egregious an example as, for example, in the 2006 Paris-Roubaix, when the riders who finished second, third and fourth, who, off the top of my head, were Leif Hoster, Peter van Petegem and Vladimir Gusev. I mean, they actually went between the barriers and, you know, just in front of the train. And when they got to the velodrome in Roubaix, they were told they'd been disqualified. And rightly so, I think. That was dangerous. But then on that same occasion, Tom Boonen and other riders went under the barrier before it had officially lifted and the lights had gone green again after the train had gone. Much less dangerous, although people would say, well, sometimes one train follows another, so you shouldn't do that either. And this incident happened 10 kilometres from the finish. So, I mean, a very different situation to today. But, you know, this incident did have a bearing on the race in the sense that the brake advantage rocketed up to 5 minutes. And I thought there was going to be some, you know, maybe a bit more discussion about whether or not the brake should have been asked to wait by the side of the road or slow down for a couple of minutes just to maintain the previous gap. But they didn't do that.
Lionel, that incident was, as you said, 213 kilometres to go. We had almost 100 kilometres then with the pattern was really set for the race. You talked about the gap. It never went above 6 minutes. It was around sort of 5.5 minutes for a long time. But then a new phase and really the finale started. We used to talk about the finale of the Tour of Flanders starting with maybe 60 kilometres to go. It started really with about 120 kilometres to go, I would say, with around about the Eikenberg when Red Bull and UAE really started sort of massing at the front in a very kind of purposeful way. We didn't really see significant attacks immediately, but that was the Eikenberg 120 kilometers ago. 114 kilometers ago, we had the Wolfenberg. There we did have a couple of sort of tentative moves. Christophe Laporte was off the front briefly, and you sensed then that the race was starting to simmer and it was about to boil over, and that's exactly what happened on the Molenberg.
Yeah, and it was Florian Vermeersch of UAE Team Emirates who drove into the bottom of the Molenberg with Pogacar very close behind, and that dragged away a group of 17 riders, didn't it? Mathieu van der Poel and Michael Gogel of Alpecin, Premier Tech were there, Mohoric, Magnus Sheffield and Sam Watson, they're both Ineos riders. Mohoric, of course, is Bahrain. Mads Pedersen of Lidl Trek. Remco Evenepoel, Mike van Dijk and Gianni Vermeersch of Red Bull. Jasper Stuyven of Soudal Quickstep. Stan De Wolf of Decathlon. Wout van Aert and Christophe Laporte of Visma Lisa Bike, and Matteo Trentin and Rick Ploumers of Tudor Pro Cycling. And I mean, that was pretty much everyone from the sort of A list of favourites and a good sprinkling of B and C favourites, wasn't it?
No one had really missed out, except a couple of teams you could say had missed out. EF Education had missed out, but they had Lamperti in the front group. There were a couple of other teams you could tell were slightly panicked. Groupama didn't have anyone really represented, you know, X as well, and they tried to stitch everything back together. They were unsuccessful in that. But Lionel, the group, the break, of course, the morning break, so to speak, was still out there, but they would get caught with 79 kilometers to go, and suddenly you had 30 riders at the front of the peloton. But then, of course, members of that breakaway started to drop pretty quickly. And the next key moment, I suppose, Lionel, was the second time. Remember, it's three times up the Oude Quaremont in the Tour of Flanders nowadays. And it was the second time up the Oude Quaremont with 57 kilometers to go, when we didn't see the big lead out. We didn't see Florian Vermeersch kind of in... Who was it who did the lead out last year? Was it Narváez? But Pogacar certainly benefited from that in the past, from teammates. Because the group was quite small at that point, round about 20 to 30 riders, it was a little bit cagey. And I don't feel as though they went into the bottom of the Oude Quaremont with the same speed that they would usually go in. Everyone was sort of feeling each other out. And I didn't feel that the Pogacar, we knew that this would be a sort of softening up blow. But I felt the Pogacar move was maybe even slightly tentative compared to the second ascent of the Quaremont in previous years.
Yeah, possibly, because everybody was in that group and it didn't need to be, it wasn't really necessary to whittle down. It was already whittled down, wasn't it? And it's still 57K to go, a long way to go, a lot of riding to do. And so it was just to try and tease out the big four on his wheel, wasn't it, really? And that's what happened. It was Pogacar. Van Aert was the first to react. He looked really good at this stage. Mads Pedersen was looking good. Remco Evenepoel. And then the last man to kind of get across was Mathieu van der Poel, whose positioning might have been a little bit suspect coming into the bottom of the Oude Quaremont that time. But by the top, the five of them were away, and it was already starting to sort of break up a little bit from that point, wasn't it? Because Van Aert was struggling a bit at the top. Mads Pedersen had lost touch a little bit. And it just felt like, well, there's only sort of three to five riders still in contention, and there's a lot of riding to do between the climbs, and we still have the Paterberg and then another loop of the Oude Quaremont and Paterberg to go. And that was at the point where it was just a case of, well, this is just going to be another couple of blows with the sledgehammer and the race will be done.
And in fact, that was the end of Van Aert and Pedersen as far as their victory chances were concerned. Because as you say, they were very close. They looked good on the Oude Quaremont, but they would never get back in touch. It was ultimately Remco Evenepoel, Tadej Pogacar and Mathieu van der Poel who went away over the top of the Quaremont and came into the Paterberg. So the first time at the Paterberg together, this was 51 kilometers to go. And here Remco maybe got a little bit carried away. I mean, he'd ridden a sort of textbook race up until this point, very sort of active, very much at the front of the proceedings with his team. Some people might argue a bit too sort of active, too much, too often in the wind. But he seemed to want to kind of meet Pogacar blow for blow on the Paterberg, was almost alongside him riding up the Paterberg, and ultimately seemed to pay for that because he was dropped on the upper slopes, on the steepest slopes of the Paterberg. And then we were down to two, and it was Van der Poel and Pogacar. And that pairing and their gap to Evenepoel became the sort of storyline for the next phase of the race.
Yeah, you're right. I think Remco Evenepoel did get a bit excited. And I think this is where that I'm not going to be stupid enough to say that Remco Evenepoel doesn't know the roads. Of course he does. He's ridden them all before. He's raced on some of them. But I think there's a difference in racing a Tour of Flanders on these roads and, you know, any other race or training on these roads. And it's often on those parts of the course after the climbs where the differences get made. Just not easing up when the gradient eases up. We've seen this so many times before with the likes of Pogacar and Van der Poel, who really know every inch of the road so well. And I think that's what caught Remco Evenepoel out. You're seeing the top of the Paterberg and thinking, oh, this is, I can just nudge in front of Pogacar here, not realizing that actually it goes up, the cobbles turn on the slightly to the left, and then it's still onto the concrete road, it's still dragging up a bit before. And so the gap between the Paterberg and the Koppenberg, where Remco Evenepoel was closing the gap down and getting very close, you know, the effort probably caught him out on the Koppenberg, because by the time he got to the top, the gap had gone ballooning back out again, and he had to do it all over again. And then, I mean, they're horrible, horrible roads to chase on. He was riding sort of flat out for 10 minutes and the gap comes down 10 metres. I mean, it was a real thankless chase. The next time he really got within touching distance was after the Maria Borestrat cobbles, and there was that right-hand turn, wasn't there? And the two in front slowed down and it was kind of almost touching distance. But of course, as they came through the corner, Evenepoel then also had to slow down. So it must have been agonising to get so close a couple of occasions but not be able to get back in contention. But like I say, I think what would have happened if he had got back on is that he would have been first to go backwards again on the next climb.
Yeah, it felt at this stage as though Pogacar was sort of, if you'll forgive the kind of graphic image, like a cat playing with a half-dead mouse, sort of pawing it. Certainly, every time Pogacar went to the front, it looked, and I think this was the commentator's interpretation line, or you were watching TNT, I was watching TNT in Sportster, but it seemed as though Pogacar was very keen for Evenepoel not to get back on. Vanderpool's turns weren't quite as long, maybe weren't quite as hard as Pogacar's turns. Maybe for him, that would have been a favourable scenario for Evenepoel to get back on, creating a situation where they could sort of chase together should they get dropped. Not sure about that. I know there was sort of clamour on social media again. Why was Vanderpool pulling? Why was he so generous with Pogacar? We can discuss that in the second part. But certainly, it was pretty agonising, wasn't it? Because he got it back to about 10 seconds again. But we knew that the next finish line was going to be was the Eau de Quaremont. The last time at the Eau de Quaremont, 19 kilometres to go. Remco still wasn't back. And we wondered where Pogacar would sort of swing his blade there. And it was before they even got to the cobbles. It was right at the bottom of the Eau de Quaremont. And he immediately opened up a gap. But that gap didn't maybe stretch out to the extent we thought it would. And even on the second half of the Eau de Quaremont, it looked as though the gap had sort of stabilised at around 5 seconds. And you thought Vanderpool might even be able to get back on over the top. But then they went towards the Paterberg and it started to open up again. And by the time Pogacar got to the top of the Paterberg, it was around about 15 seconds. And ordinarily, Lionel, you would say, well, all still to play for. But we'd already heard that after the Paterberg, there was headwind for about 4 kilometres and then a right turn. And thereafter, it was going to be tailwind. And I don't know about you, Lionel, but throughout the sort of last 50 kilometres or so, on all of the climbs, although Vanderpool had been able to stick with Pogacar, I didn't think he looked as though he was on a great day, one of his greatest days. His sort of head was rolling, his shoulders were rolling a little bit. And I thought that his goose was pretty much cooked at the top of the Paterberg with 15 seconds deficit from Pogacar.
Yeah, I thought so as well. I mean, again, you know, the gaps look really small on the TV, but they take an awful lot of closing. And well, as we know, they went out on the run-in. You made the point about Pogacar attacking before they even reached the cobbles on the Eau de Quaremont. And I think that was strategic because he got out of the saddle, didn't he, on the smooth road. It's actually quite steep, that bit, before they get onto the cobbles. So it was just a, you know, you're talking, what, 20, 30 metres of opportunity, but he took it. And he had Vanderpool on the back foot before they even hit the cobbles. And that was where the gap started opening. But at that stage, I was with you, Daniel. I thought Vanderpool looked like he was riding very calmly, not panicking, holding the gap, fighting back on the slightly flatter section, and perhaps had Pogacar worried because he looked over his shoulder at least twice, perhaps even three times, as they went through the village of Quaremont, and then it kicks up again. It didn't look like Pogacar was convinced it was done at that stage, and we sort of didn't see the section where the gap opened up again. But after the Quadamont and the run to the Paterberg, there's a, you know, it's quite technical as well, you know, and if you can ride it fast, as Pogacar obviously did, there was the opportunity to open up that gap again. And I, from that moment on, I thought it was done, because really, man against man on the Paterberg, you would expect Pogacar to eke out a few seconds over Van der Poel on the on a climb that steep, as it proved.
Yeah, and meanwhile, behind Pogacar, everyone was, well, it was the race, as I said at the start of the episode, was completely blown apart. Everyone was sort of scattered across the hillsides. You had, and Pedersen was now on his own, Van Aert was now on his own, Evenepoel was now on his own. And indeed, that's how they would finish. So Tadej Pogacar would win the Tour of Flanders in time, 6 hours, 20 minutes average speed. What was it, line 43.9? Not the fastest edition ever, but the last four editions of the Tour of Flanders, I think I'm right in saying, have been the fastest four ever. I think today was maybe the third or fourth fastest ever. So Pogacar, the winner, 275 UCI points. No, 800 UCI points final. Noted, make a note. Second, Mathieu van der Poel, 34 seconds behind Remco Evenepoel. A fantastic debut for him. 1 minute, 11 seconds down Wout van Aert. Fourth, 2 minutes, 4 seconds, Mads Pedersen. Fifth, 2 minutes, 48 seconds. And then a huge gap to Jasper Stuyven of Sudal Quickstep, Florian Vermeersch, Matej Mohoric, Christophe Laporte, and Jani Miersman closing out the top 10. Jani Miersman down in 10th place. That's 5 minutes, 22. Jani Miersman retired years ago. 5 minutes, 22 seconds down.
Yeah, just on those time gaps. I mean, they're really unusual for the Tour of Flanders. Never really see time gaps as big as this across the top five or top 10. I was looking back through the race results. I mean, you have to go back 31 years to 1995 when Johan Museeuw won the race, and 10th place was at 3 minutes 28. 10th place today was at 5:22. Even the 1985 edition, when Erik van der Aarden won in real apocalyptic wet conditions, 10th place managed to get home 3 minutes 48 after him. 1983, the largest time gap in recent history, and I mean, that's what, 43 years ago, Jan Raas won, and 10th place was at 6 minutes 22. And normally we see, yes, the race breaks up a lot, but they come home in, you know, groups, I don't know, a minute back and then another minute or whatever. But the, you know, the gaps were significant from very early on, I'd suggest. I think I sent you a message, Daniel, at the point when they went and said, you know, 10th place will be at about 5 minutes at this rate. And that's what happened.
And there were a lot of additions around about, particularly the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, where you had huge bunches coming, 20, 30 riders. And there was often talk that if we ever got a day where it was headwind for a lot of the route, there would be a bunch sprint, or there could be a full bunch sprint for the Tour of Flanders. Those days seem a very long time ago now. Lionel, should we conclude part one there, and in part two we will analyze a little bit more what we saw today?
Yeah, time for a bit more chocolate egg and some Leffe Zero.
Well, Lionel, another monument victory for Tadej Pogacar. He's now drawn clear of Roger de Vlaeminck in career monuments. He's on his own now behind Eddy Merckx. I don't have the tally in front of me. I really should have looked that up before I started a part with that, but I know that to be the case. Is it 17 Merckx? Was it 18 Merckx? You see, I'm kind of getting mixed up at this point with Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods and majors, and Tiger Woods is very much in the news at the moment and I'm all confused.
It's anyway, 19 for Eddy Merckx.
19 and 11 for Pogacar, is that right?
12 for Pogacar.
12 for Pogacar.
11 there for de Vlaeminck. Roger de Vlaeminck's having a bad Sunday night in Flanders.
And Roger ain't winning anymore, I don't think. Whereas today, Pogacar might win another one next week. You'll have seen him, Lionel, sort of greeting one by one. Or when sort of the likes of Pedersen came over the line, Van Aert came over the line, there was the sort of formality of telling them, I'll see you next week. And there was something slightly menacing in that, something slightly ominous. Just like, as I wrote on Twitter, there was something slightly ominous and menacing about Pogacar having what looked like a tiny napkin flapping from his flapping from his neck for about, I don't know, 50 kilometers in the middle of the race, as though he was about to, you know, tuck into his supper. And he duly did tuck in and fill his boots, didn't he? If that's not mixing metaphors, which I think it is. But Lionel, the thing that really struck me about this performance from Tadej Pogacar, it was surgical, it was predictable, we sort of knew how he was going to do it. Again, interesting contrast between this race and Milan-San Remo. In Milan-San Remo, he didn't have a formula yet, because nothing had worked yet. And in the Tour of Flanders, he'd seen very well what worked. He knew the climb that worked. He knew that the Eau de Quaremont, over 2 kilometers long, and we talked about how long it would take him a couple of weeks ago, but he knew that that was going to be Van der Poel's Achilles heel. He had that over Van der Poel. Incidentally, Van der Poel's been talking in the press, or maybe his entourage has been talking in the press, about how he had really focused hard this winter on training for a slightly longer effort, specifically with the Quaremont in mind, in the hope of sort of thwarting Pogacar. It didn't work, but it was sort of surgical, clinical, predictable, but I think what made it doubly impressive from my point of view, I suppose, was that phase in the race before the second time up the Eau de Quaremont. So between the Molenberg and the Eau de Quaremont, so sort of 100 kilometers to go to 60 kilometers to go, just how much work Pogacar was doing. And it didn't seem like a very economical race at all. And at that point, I would sort of made a mental note to myself, if he doesn't win today, then our mind, our focus will go back to that phase of the race, that sort of hour, where he was always sort of buzzing around the front of the group and always doing turns. And the group was such, the size of the group was such, that it felt as though there were some riders who were able to sort of hide and sort of mince about and skulk around at the back, even Van Aert at certain points. Whereas Pogacar was always sort of in the first five or six wheels.
Yeah, but he probably thought that this was an opportunity that he didn't want to waste. You know, the whittling down had happened much to his advantage as well as to everybody else's. Yes, he had some pretty impressive company in there. You know, let's face it, if, say, one of Van Aert, Van der Poel, or even Remco Evenepoel or Mads Pedersen had not made that split after the Molenberg, we would have seen a very different race. There would have been a lot more action from behind. As it was, as you said, Daniel, really it was a handful of sort of teams. Probably Kasper Asgreen of EF Education Easy Post, 2021 winner of the Tour of Flanders, of course, was the most frustrated rider. But there really wasn't a concerted effort behind. And that gap went up to the what was left of the peloton to a couple of minutes. And so I suspect that was because Pogacar wanted to participate in making sure that there wasn't too much playing around at that point and that it didn't all come back together again. And then he did sort of give himself a bit of a break once it was obvious that that time gap was going to be enough to get them into the bottom of the Eau de Quaremont. But you're right, he did do a lot of work and he rode, well, in hindsight, with a lot of confidence and took a lot of responsibility. And you can't really criticise him for that. But as you say, had he been beaten, the errors might well have looked a bit more obvious to us in hindsight.
Lionel, even more so after today, because of the time gaps we just mentioned, there will be criticism, or there will be questions raised about this route, which we've had for a few years now. And there are a lot of people who feel that it's too difficult and it's too hilly and it's changed the fundamental nature of the race. One thing I do think that makes it really interesting as far as Pogacar is concerned is the positioning, the placement of that second of the three ascents of the Quaremont, because I do feel as though it's so daunting from that point that he can't afford, and I don't think he would dare, to strike out there thinking that he can do what he's done before in Strade Bianche, for example, and go 80 kilometers or do what he's done in the World Championships before. Bearing in mind that, okay, we say this is more of a climber's race now, but there is still a preponderance of sort of big rulers, you know, guys over 70 kilos, who, if they got together in a chase, they could make life very difficult for him if he did try to go away there. And obviously, you know, he's never going to have a minute at the top of the Quaremont. Best case scenario, he's going to have sort of 15 seconds, 20 seconds. So he does have to sort of bide his time, and he has to use each of these climbs as in a sort of gradual attritional whittling down process, and that's what he does. And when I say he's found the recipe, that is the recipe, isn't it, for him?
It is, and I suppose it comes back to this fundamental question of what is a classic monument one-day race for? Is it to find out who the best riders in the world are? If that's the case, well, the Tour of Flanders route as it is at the moment is absolutely ideal. I mean, the five best riders in the world at the moment were in positions 1 to 5, weren't they? I mean, you could argue that maybe a Tom Pidcock might have been in there had he been on the start line. Or is the race to be watched as a kind of uncertain, dramatic, you know, is it purely for entertainment? And I think that the organisers have got a tricky question to answer over the next few years, because clearly from a commercial point of view, all of the marquees and the grandstands that have grown over years, you know, to a point where now they look like, you know, part of the furniture. I mean, it looks like coming up the 18th at Augusta on the Isle de Quiremont now, doesn't it? With all the grandstands and everything. So they're not going to change the laps of the Isle de Quiremont, but the nature of the roads of Flanders are such that they could make that middle ascent, instead of coming 55, 57 kilometres from the end, they could make that further away and therefore make it much harder for Pogacar to make the decisive move. 55 kilometres is kind of on the cusp of what's doable, isn't it? If that was 75 kilometres, it would throw a real question mark over whether the tactic would be the same. And of course, the final ascent of the Quiremont, coming, what, 16, 18 kilometres from the end, is just that little bit too close, and there's too much left to risk if the group's still big. So it's not like the race is necessarily fixed, but at the moment, with this layout and this configuration, I mean, Pogacar's cracked it. It's very, very difficult to see what anyone else could have done. And Van der Poel's only tactic was to try and stay on the wheel as long as he could. And, you know, that proved difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it looks, if you look at the time gaps, it looks like a very emphatic victory. You could still argue that it's fine margins. Okay, Pogacar and Van der Poel are probably a long way ahead of the rest, but if it had been 10 seconds over the top of the Paterberg rather than 15 seconds, then we might have had a different outcome, and we might have had Van der Poel able to chase Pogacar down. So, I mean, the great thing with the Tour of Flanders, as far as the organisers is concerned, is that it's pretty easy to tweak the route. Tiny tweaks. We're not talking about major surgery. You know, we've talked for years, in the days before Milan-San Remo had become everyone's favourite race, as L'Equipe called it a few weeks ago, le classique le plus sexy, hein? The sexiest classic in the world, le classique. Milan-San Remo, you can't, that the great sort of headache with Milan-San Remo for years has been there simply aren't other roads. There's one climb, La Pompeiana, that they've talked about using before, but there's not an awful lot you can do. With the Tour of Flanders, you can go left at the top and then do a little loop. And, you know, if you want the Quiremont, the penultimate ascent of the Quiremont to come 62 kilometres from the finish, you can find a way to make that happen, or 63 kilometres or 64 kilometres.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would think maybe the organisers would look at that. But I think there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, about what is good for the race organisers. And although it might not be necessarily the greatest thing for those of us who've been watching cycling 30, 40 years, and kind of I felt like I've seen this movie before, the Tour of Flanders is beginning to feel a little bit samey. Nevertheless, we haven't quite seen the sort of the five best riders in the world get pulled clear in quite this way. Usually someone's missing, or usually there's somebody else in there that's sort of spoiling the order. So it was quite an exceptional result. And we'll look back probably at this edition of the Tour of Flanders in sort of 10, 20 years' time as kind of the sort of peak moment of this Pogacar, Van der Poel, Van Aert, you know, Remco Evenepoel kind of quadrant. These riders who in certain circumstances are very well matched, but very well matched up to a point.
Yeah, and you touched on it earlier, Lionel, but whatever the sort of armchair fans or we might think, as far as the organisers are concerned, the only way that today could have been improved would have been with a Belgian winner, but otherwise, they will be absolutely delighted with what they got today. Just thinking about Vanderpool again, I touched on it earlier. There was a suggestion, certainly on social media, but we get this after every classic, every monument, that he was too generous, he worked too much with Pogacar. I think it's really difficult to know exactly. I referenced earlier that moment in the race, or that phase in the race, where Pogacar and Van der Poel were together and Remco was sort of hanging behind and the gap was oscillating. It's really difficult to know how hard the pulls he was taking were, but some people would have preferred him not to work at all with Pogacar there and not to work with him much earlier in the race as well. And this seems to be, as far as some people are concerned, this is the answer. Just stop working with Pogacar. But Van der Poel himself, before the race today, he was interviewed about whether he might race more defensively today. And I think his answer sort of encapsulated why riders like him will never race defensively, or will really have to be persuaded to race more defensively. He just sort of said that, you know, I want to be a protagonist. I want to be the strongest, or trying to follow the strongest. And unfortunately, the ego, and that's not, I'm not saying that in a negative sense, but the ego of these best riders in the world is such that, given the opportunity to sort of test themselves against Pogacar, they want to see if they can go toe-to-toe with him. And that's generally why they ride with him.
Yeah, I mean, Van der Poel's trying to win the race, isn't he? He's in a group of two. Odds are looking pretty good at that stage, certainly better than if he was in a group of five or six at the same stage, and lots more people to consider. And I think the riders themselves don't think about, they're not thinking about their weaknesses, or, you know, how best do I, you know, how do I minimize my chances of losing. They're thinking about how do they maximize their chances of winning. And I think, you know, you talk about the ego of Van der Poel, the ego of Van der Poel was, I think, in evidence on the Quadamont when he didn't panic. He didn't kind of, you know, try and bluff his way out of a situation that he was in. He just tried to kind of hold the gap and ride kind of conservatively, not do anything silly. And in a way, that is parking his ego. It, you know, it's riding the best way to get back on terms, and it nearly worked for him. But these races, they're such a, you know, the margins are so fine. And I think we saw an awful lot today that explains the kind of essence of the Tour of Flanders, especially to people who maybe are used to watching the Tour de France and are relatively new to these races. The gaps look like, well, surely that he's going to close that gap. That's going to, if that was a stage of the Tour de France, the gap would close. And in these races, it just doesn't. You know, Evenepoel's chase was agonizing to watch, really. You know, the discipline and the kind of the resolve to just keep going, rather than ease up and think, well, Van Aert and Mads Pedersen are behind, that would be quite a nice little trio, maybe we'd have more chance. I think it tells you that they know instinctively that they wouldn't have more chance in a group of three if the gap was another 50 metres, 100 metres, because the roads are so difficult to chase on. And I think that was a real kind of, you know, purists, perhaps textbook example of, you know, why we see the Tour of Flanders go the way it does so often, with riders looking like, you know, all they're doing is just riding in order. And I think, you know, I'm the attention deficit junkie. I want the excitement and the wow of it all coming back together and then seeing something else unfold. But even I can appreciate that, you know, there's something quite sort of powerful about watching the best riders in the world giving it absolutely everything for almost no gain.
Yeah. Another criticism that's been levelled at Van der Poel and the way he's ridden, or the way his team has ridden, is a criticism that was levelled at them after Milan-San Remo, that they shouldn't have contributed so much early in the race. Sylvain Dillier shouldn't have done that massive stint on the front. Well, they did something completely different today, and they sent Dillier around down the road, and really there was no one significantly helping UAE for a long time in the race. Then we saw the strength of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and we've seen how strong they've been throughout the spring so far. another suggestion was that they, instead of pulling at certain points in the sort of middle of the race, they should have been alternating attacks, firing attacks down the road. I imagine, and maybe this is a bit of a weakness in their master plan to sort of unveil Remco 2 days before the Tour of Flanders. I imagine they were sort of confident about his ability to maybe surprise people today, which he did. But at the same time, they also wanted to give him the best possible chance of doing that by sort of cocooning him. And that's what they did, effectively. And again, I think it was probably a pleasant surprise to them how it all worked out. And I think they'll be really satisfied. But they very much rode for him and as though he had a chance of winning the race, which ultimately, you know, he came pretty close to doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best debut at the Tour of Flanders since Casper Asgreen's second place in 2019. I think Mads Pedersen was also second in 2018 on his debut. So third place on his first race at the Tour of Flanders it's impressive, even for a rider of Remco Evenepoel's stature. You know, world titles, Olympic titles, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Vuelta a España. You know, the Tour of Flanders is cut from different cloth, and they did a very good job of keeping him in a very good position. And they were, of all the teams, I'm sure they would have been delighted to have got into probably the trickiest approach to any of the climbs is the one to the Molenberg, especially at that stage of the race. The Paterberg is also tricky, but it's generally thinned out a lot more by then. The Molenberg's a real pinch point. And when they emerged from the top of the Molenberg, Remco had two teammates with him. And it was Jannie Vermeersch, wasn't it? And it was Mick van Dijkke. And at that point, they must have looked around and thought, we're in a really good position here. Because all of the fighting, all of the, you know, all Remco Evenepoel had to do from that point on was mark two or three of the best riders in the world and choose his moment to make his effort. I mean, I don't know whether you were surprised by his performance and result. I don't think I was. I think it's quite peculiar, really, that a rider of Remco Evenepoel's stature, especially considering he's Belgian, the question of his participation in the Tour of Flanders should be such a sort of, you know, magician appearing from behind what do magicians appear behind from behind? Sheet, shield. I know shield. Yeah. You know what I mean. The great reveal.
Yeah.
The stupendous Remco.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm sort of conflicted about this because, you know, we talk about this race having changed fundamentally in nature. It's really changed in the last, when the Paterberg loop was introduced in 2012, wasn't it? But it's changed and cycling has changed with it, and other things have changed as well. For example, equipment has changed, and everyone tells us that the riding on cobbles is not maybe such a fine art as it used to be because of things like 28 millimeter tires or even fatter tires and better bikes that are better able to absorb vibrations and so on and so forth. So it's kind of evolved towards riders like Remco, but I'm still surprised. Pro Cycling Stats in their live today, still they posted the average weight of the top 10 in the last 5 years, and it was still sort of 74 kilos. It hasn't changed that much, as against the Tour of Lombardy, 62 kilos average weight of top 10 finishes for the last 5 years. So yeah, there was a bit of some mystery for me today, but certainly I got a sense listening to him and while seeing the coverage over the last few days and just sort of getting a sense of how familiar he was with a lot of these roads. And of course he is, because you know he grew up not very far from some of the key climbs in the Tour of Flanders, and he's ridden them on a regular basis, and he's even raced on them on a fairly regular basis in things like junior races. So surprised to a degree, but certainly, you know, when I sort of turned on my TV and I saw the way he was moving in the peloton, he looked as though he'd been there all his life, really. And I don't know whether that speaks more to his natural ability or, as I say, to the changing or the different nature nowadays of the Tour of Flanders.
Yeah, I mean, he's never ridden a professional Omloop Het Nieuwsblad or Kerner Brussels Kerner or E3 or Gent Wevelgem or any of the kind of races that are traditionally the sort of build up to the Tour of Flanders. But he's a top quality rider. I do wonder, you know, we're talking about the sort of the fine degrees. I think the final 60, 70K of the race might have been very different if that very heavy rain shower, which didn't last very long, but it came when the riders were approaching the Valkenburg, which is a smooth climb. And by the time they got back to the cobbled climbs, the sun was back out and the roads were drying up a bit. I mean, if that heavy rain shower had happened when they were on the Quadamont, the middle time round, or on the Paterberg or Koppenberg, it could have been a very different finale. But these are the factors that change and make and shape the race. It didn't rain when it would have been the most unhelpful. And, that would have been a real test for not just Remco Evenepoel's handling on the cobbles, but it would have maybe tipped the balance in favour of the heavier riders if the cobbles had been properly wet.
Lionel, another thing that occurs to me is if Tadej Pogacar didn't exist now, tonight in particular, we'd be having the debate of whether Remco Evenepoel's excellent performance here, third place here, now introduces a dilemma in his career, whether he now has to choose, is it classics rider or Grand Tour rider? In Pogacar and what Pogacar's done, and even in Pogacar's race program this year, I mean, every rider's different. It's maybe not every rider can sort of stick to this rhythm of almost like fortnightly appointments, which Pogacar is doing this year. But there is a bit of a blueprint there. And maybe Remco will recognize that, and in future seasons we'll see him doing something similar, because he's not going to sacrifice the Ardennes Classics. I mean, I think of all of the sort of different boxes in professional cycling, Grand Tours, one-day races, one-week stage races, cobbled classics, hilly classics are still the ones that correspond most squarely to what Remco Evenepoel is as an athlete.
Yeah, and I think the Belgian fans will be glad to have the possibility of Remco Evenepoel riding the Tour of Flanders in future, because it definitely, you see even on the TV, and I know from having been there, and you've been to the Tour of Flanders several times as well, but the having Belgian riders, and in the case of Van Aert, a true Flandrian rider in contention, it does ramp up the excitement and the anticipation. You said that the Belgian drought in the men's Tour of Flanders is nothing compared to the French drought in the men's Tour de France. I'd agree with that, obviously, in terms of how long it's gone on. But the intensity in Flanders is such, I think Belgium have won 69 editions of the race, well clear of anybody else, and they've never gone anywhere like a 9-year streak without a Belgian winner of the Tour of Flanders. I think they'll be getting a little bit concerned about this.
Which brings us to Wout van Aert. I think broadly speaking, Wout van Aert's spring has been very positive, particularly given where he comes from. Obviously, he broke his wrist in that cyclocross race. I've mentioned this cyclocross more than I've ever mentioned any other cyclocross race in my life. This is the famous Mol cyclocross race. What did I say? The wrist. Mads Pedersen was the one who broke his wrist. He broke his ankle. But we saw that sort of agonizing near miss at Dwars Door Vlaanderen in the week. And today, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what Van Aert has said after today's race. But, you know, we talked about Remco getting carried away on the Paterberg. Maybe Van Aert got a little bit carried away on the Quaremont the first time round, because he was the only one who looked vaguely comfortable following Pogacar until three quarters of the way up the Quaremont. And then very quickly, within the space of 20 seconds, he went from looking like Pogacar's biggest threat to not seeing Pogacar again. And obviously, I think most people would have agreed even before today that Paris-Roubaix represents a better opportunity for him than the Tour of Flanders. But there will also be plenty of people asking tonight whether another classic season is going to go by in agonizing fashion for Van Aert.
Yeah, you mentioned the Dwars Door Vlaanderen. I mean, it was the most impressive we've seen Van Aert really for quite a long time, and he very nearly pulled it off, didn't he? I mean, it was a super quick race. They got round in under 4 hours. He was away on his own. He was looking strong. He was kind of, it was shades of Pogacar and Van der Poel, wasn't it? And it definitely made him a pre-race favourite for today's race. But there was still the nagging sense that he didn't get it done in a race like Dwars Door Vlaanderen. And yes, I know Philippe Ganna, you know, like a bolt from the blue in the final 500 metres, very impressive. But, you know, when those results, those races, they just slip away. I'm not saying that if he'd won Dwars Door Vlaanderen, he would have got a better result or ridden a little bit better in the Tour of Flanders. But it's just indicative that, you know, when the wins aren't coming, they don't come. And he was the next level down. But for that fleeting moment, it did look like, you know, he's back to kind of the peak Van Aert from a few years ago. It's just very unfortunate. If Pogacar didn't exist, if Van der Poel didn't exist, we'd be talking about Wout van Aert as the greatest classics rider of the generation. But, you know, that's the ifs and buts. I mean, you know, get rid of a few thousand riders and I could say the same. A few hundred thousand riders.
Yeah. Lionel, any other performances you'd like to mention in dispatches? I'm just looking down the results. Matej Moric has had a rough couple of years in classics, eighth place. There's not going to be an awful lot of time spent talking about his Tour of Flanders, but I thought he rode a solid race and that'll be a welcome return to form of sorts.
Yeah, and they had a plan, didn't they? Because they had Gradec in the early break as well, yeah. And they looked pretty good. I mentioned Philippe Ganna there, obviously didn't start today, which some people might have been surprised about because I think he was eighth last year, or was that the year before? Certainly he's been up there in the Tour of Flanders, hasn't he? He won Dwars Door Vlaanderen on Wednesday. Rode really strongly and did kind of what we thought he might do in Flanders Fields, didn't we? You know, you were talking about the Italian fans being up in arms that he was working for Sam Watson. Well, he did what we'd anticipated him doing in Dwars Door Vlaanderen, and it paid off. But he and his team opted to have an easier weekend. He was at home watching the race on TV and having a nice Easter Sunday lunch because Paris-Roubaix is his best bet of a podium of the two. And I think correct decision, but I think it does also explain why Ineos Grenadiers were so active getting Conor Swift in the break. He actually crashed while he was in that break, didn't he? I think either adjusting his clothing or his radio cable or something, and a bit of a nasty crash, but got back up. Sam Watson rode really very well as well to get in that move.
Interestingly, didn't finish Sam Watson. We don't know what happened to him exactly, but he was certainly very, very heavily involved until deep into the race. You mentioned a crash there, Conor Swift's crash. And we should also mention that Matteo Trentin, who's another rider who was with Pogacar, Pedersen, et al. Up until the penultimate ascent of the Quaremont, he had a bad crash and has been taken to hospital. I don't know exactly where that crash happened.
But really, it was a day, wasn't it, that was about a handful of riders and everyone else is just on the results sheet. You know, I don't mean to say that disrespectfully, but I can't recall a race really where it's not like there were apocalyptic conditions that would explain the way it shook down and just how far back everybody else was. But
there were certain guys who, when they came in, they'd grown a beard and had two kids since the last time we'd seen them. They were that far down.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. There'll be a rematch of sorts at Paris-Roubaix next Sunday, won't there? Can Pogacar make it three monuments in a row? Oof,
indeed. Lionel, we'll probably talk this week a little bit more about this sort of storm in a teacup around Remco Evenepoel's big reveal, as we've called it, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Of course, a bit of sort of teeth gnashing, particularly among some of our colleagues in the media, about the way they made that announcement and certainly kept that information from the media for 100 days, as Ralph Denk was very proud to tell us. We'll probably talk about that in the episode later in the week. I'm going to be at the Tour of the Basque Country this week, so we're going to have to fit in our recording around that, I suppose. But anything else to mention, Lionel, before we wish everyone a very good evening?
Just a clarification there. Of course, Pogacar going for three monuments in a row this season. The run goes back to include Lombardia and Liège-Bastogne-Liège last season. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on the sort of sequence of numbers. I think we did do it last year, but you know, he's raced 3 days this year and he's won Strade Bianche, Milan San Remo and the Tour of Flanders. I mean, the consistency and the high level of performance is I've never seen anything like this. I mean, I was born in 1975 when Eddie Merckx was just a little over the hill, but this is unprecedented.
And the last time he competed in a race and did not win was in September. That was that pretty rotten day he had in the time trial at the World Championships in Rwanda when he was fourth and, of course, caught by Remco Evenepoel. And if you exclude that, if you disregard that, Lionel, the last time he competed in a race, road race, and didn't win, Montreal in September, 14th of September, when, of course, he let Brandon McNulty win and he would have won that as well.
Yeah, I mentioned time trialing and Remco. I mean, he did a pretty impressive 46-kilometre time trial of his own today, didn't he? I mean, last word for Remco, really, because that was the ride of the day. I mean, it was just the demoralising aspect of getting so close, not once but twice, and just being able to see the riders in front, knowing exactly where they are and not being able to get to them. And I think the finish line shot was, you know, Pogacar crossed the line and you could see Van der Poel kind of coming into view. And then as Van der Poel crossed the line, you could see Remco Evenepoel. You know, they were almost within touching distance of one another, but just the impossible gap.
Lionel, I think that concludes our Arrivée podcast on the Tour of Flanders. We'll be back in the week and then with Paris-Roubaix Arrivée next week. Of course, we've got the Arrivée for the women's edition of the Tour of Flanders coming later this evening.
We have indeed, with Rose Manley and Lizzie Banks. So listen out for that. See you in the week, Daniel. Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.